When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Streams of Winter, Live Stream 9, Prologue.
Hello and welcome to The Streams of Winter. I am Yoke Boy and we are Radio Westeros. Thanks for tuning in to our live stream this afternoon. Today we'll be talking about a single chapter in The Winds of Winter, but a very important one. Prologues are there to set up the books ahead, and so we will be discussing The Winds prologue today. What do we know about the prologue, and what can we therefore predict? To help me answer these prologue-related questions, here's the other half of Radio Westeros, Lady Gwyn.
Hello. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this Saturday live stream. Excited to be talking about one of my very favorite topics in the upcoming book, The Winds of Winter, that I'm sure you've all heard of. I'm going to be talking about the prologue, the Riverlands, everything and anything that we can think of that might come into play in that chapter. And to help us, we're lucky that we have a friend who also loves to talk about the Riverlands and everything that's going on there. Today, we are happy to welcome Joe Buckley from the Isle of Faces podcast. Whoops, there we go. Thank you, Joe. Very happy to see you here today.
Thanks for having me. Honored to be here. Honored.
Quick reminder, everyone, about spoilers. We do talk about, the books, obviously, all the books, sample chapters. And here we'll be talking about some information that George has given us about this one chapter. So this is a little bit different, like Yoke Boy said, than our usual streams. But it's basically spoilers everything. I usually give a kind of disclaimer about the TV show. But this entire storyline was pretty much left out of the TV show. So if we were just talking about this before we went live, if we start talking about the TV show, you'll know that we have gone astray. So somebody nudge us to get us back on topic, because I can't think of a single part of this that was included, really. So anyways, onwards. Why don't we get started talking about the prologue? We'll go over to you, Yoke Boy.
Okay, so I've cooked up a few questions about this prologue we're all so excited about. Okay, so going back as far as 2014, George has made comments regarding this prologue. Altogether, what do we know about the prologue from these admissions, Lady Gwyn?
Well, these comments were made back in 2014, like you said, at San Diego Comic-Con. George was sitting on a panel, and I gather the subject matter of the panel had something to do about the differences, maybe, or at least the to contextualize this statement, the differences between Game of Thrones, the TV show, and A Song of Ice and Fire. George said, "Jane Westerling is still alive and will be seen in the prologue in The Winds of Winter. But because all of his prologue characters tend to die, the fandom kind of went crazy after he made that statement and everybody started speculating about Jane's imminent death, which led to George qualifying that statement within a couple of days in an interview saying, I didn't say she was the viewpoint character. I said she was in the prologue. So there you have it. It's the word of the author. And pretty much that's what brings us here today.
So it would seem that George is conveying that Jane will be in the prologue, but the prologue will not be her POV. So at the very least, she's going to be a very important part of this prologue, and that tells us a lot about when and where it might take place. For those of us who are somewhat rusty on Jane and the Westerlings, why don't we remind folks at home of her situation in order to provide some kind of framework and context today? So during feast, Jane sets off on a long journey. Where is she? Where is she going? And how is she going to get there, Lady Gwyn?
She is, or in feast, the first time we've seen her since the Storm of Swords, when Rob left her, she is at River Run, where she's been during the siege of River Run, up until it being the capitulation of River Run to Jaime Lannister in Feast for Crows, at which point it's decided that she's going to be sent under guard, no less, to Casterly Rock, where she can be the Lannister's guest for a couple of years, after which point she'll be married off to Westerman, and not just any Westerman. Her mother demands that it must be a lord or lord's heir, as promised by the late Tywin.
Okay, and Jane was something of an ordinary girl who found herself at the center of the storm during the War of the Five Kings. Why then does she remain such an important character, in spite of her seldom appearances, now that this war is effectively over, Joe?
Well, it's mainly because the Frey Lannister Alliance, they're pretty insecure. They know they've cut some corners. They know they shouldn't really be in the position that they are. So if there's any slight anything left unchecked, then it could cause big problems even now or down the road, which is what Jane is. Because if she appears with a child, even vaguely in the realm that you could logically say it might be Rob's, then all the Riverlords are going to take that as something that they can run with. Like I say, that doesn't have to be right now. It could be in 20 years when the child is older, and then they have one of the old guard to rally around if the Freys and Lannisters aren't what they like, which is probable because they're not very nice, are they?
Because they're Freys and Lannisters.
Because they're Freys and they're Lannisters. Right.
The Freys and the Lannisters, yes, we'll be getting back to that theme later. So Jane married into the Starks and really seems to have loved our young wolf, Robb Stark. Yet members of her family schemed to give the advantage to the Lannisters in the War of the Five Kings. So what do we know about Jane's current affiliations? Lady Gwyn.
Well, what we know, very little we see of her, but quite briefly in Jaime's point of view, is that she still seems pretty loyal to Rob. She shows evidence of having recently been crying. She has a mark on her head, and Jaime asks about it, and apparently she's been wearing that crown that Rob gave her, kind of defiantly, until her mother ripped it off her head. So there's that. When she leaves River Run, Jaime notes that it appears that she's torn her clothes as a mark of mourning. So all in all, she's still pretty defiant and pretty dedicated to her late husband.
Yeah, that relationship with her mother, we don't know what it was really like beforehand, but it's certainly gone downhill since everything with the Red Wedding has come out, because her mother's not exactly coy about her imparting it or what she thinks Jane should be playing. And so Jane knows all about the kind of pregnancy blocking and all of that stuff. So obviously that's going to have a major effect on her and her relationship. So we're yet to see if that can come to a head in this chapter as well. Could well do.
Okay, and on the subject of her mother, Tywin Lannister helped orchestrate the downfall of Robb Stark, as we all know, culminating in the Red Wedding. And he brokered incentives for the Westerlings to be a part of that downfall. So what deals were made between Jane's family and Tywin? I'll go ahead. Sybil secretly gave Jane a concoction, as Joe said, to keep her getting pregnant, keep her from getting pregnant. Numerous offers of lordships were made that would elevate her house. So the Red Wedding was all planned out, but Sybil was seeking to promote her own house from the obscurity it had found itself in. And it is worth remembering, as far as Lannisters go, that later Jaime Lannister seems rather disgusted by her behavior.
I believe the phrase he uses is scheming bitch. Seems appropriate.
He's not wrong.
Well, Jamie, a good man, eventually, right? Well,
good opinions.
Maybe. It now seems that Jane is such a valuable pawn that she travels with a heavily guarded entourage that's overseen by our man Jamie. Why is there a need to guard her with such caution? Could she be carrying Rob's child, Lady Gwyn?
Yeah, I mean, Joe definitely alluded to this. She could be a rallying point for the people of the North and the Riverlands, as Rob's widow. But I think more importantly, while it's been 6 months since she last saw Rob, and you wouldn't expect her to, you know, have his child, stranger things have happened. So any child she might have during a certain time frame where they could kind of fudge it could technically be claimed as Rob's. But there's also the fact that in spite of that, you know, the concoction that her mother was giving her to keep her from getting pregnant, and Rob saying as they departed River Run that she had not conceived, we do have to kind of ask the question, could she be pregnant? Because it's definitely possible for a woman to conceal a pregnancy up until, you know, pretty late, the 6th month, that's, you know, conceivable. So what do you guys think? I mean, could she actually be pregnant? Would George go there?
I think the other issue that Jamie's and the Lannisters are kind of smart enough to see is it doesn't necessarily have to be a child of her body. If you just stick a newborn baby in her arms and say, "Look, it's Rob's," then there's no DNA to test that,
that
we could have a Aegon virus type situation. No, this is definitely Rob. Look, he's got brown hair and everything, all that. And then who is there to argue? And that's enough for the Riverlords. So they just need to make sure if they can just keep her in a room for 2 years and say, no, she's been nowhere near anyone, and she definitely doesn't have a baby. So yeah, it could be either way.
Great point, Joe. So Jamie does not go with Jane and the entourage in person, but obviously it's an important mission and is therefore given to a person in a position of Lannister trust and responsibility. So I want to know more about this kind of entourage, because this is obviously what the focus is going to be, or so we think. So who is in charge of her safety on the journey, and just why were they chosen, Lady Gwyn?
Well, the person who's in charge of her safety, or her getting to Casterly Rock, to the destination, is Sir Forley Prester. He's highly trusted member. He's a Lannister bannerman. He's been around. He's been mentioned many times. He was part of Jaime's original army that fought beneath the Golden Tooth, fought their way into the Riverlands, and then in the first siege of Riverrun, he was the one commander after Jaime was defeated at Whispering Wood. Forley Prester was the one who was able to take retreat in good order with a couple thousand Lannister soldiers. The rest of them were all falling in the river and whatever. They were a mess. Forley Prester is really the real deal. Jaime holds him in very high regard. He is actually some kind of a cousin of Jaime. His mother's mother, I believe, was a Prester, so they are cousins. Jaime even considers that he'd make a good hand of the king if Kevin Lannister refuses to take the job, when Jaime's thinking about, you know, all the ways he could restructure things back in King's Landing once he gets back there. I want to give a slightly smart aleck answer, because you asked who's in charge of Jane's safety on this journey. And according to Jaime, of course, it's Forley Prester. But according to Robb Stark, the person in charge of Jane's safety is none other than his great uncle, Brynden Blackfish Tully, who before Rob left for the Twins was created Warden of the South, Warden of the Southern Marches, and charged specifically with Queen Jane's protection. Probably a duty, if I know Blackfish, that he takes very seriously.
Wow. So it's worth remembering the Blackfish, but you really should get your head around this Fawley Prester character. We're going to have a lot more on him today. So Edmure Tully is yet another important character in the party. We need a refresher. How was he captured? And what is his value as a hostage, Lady Gwyn?
Well, he was captured at the Red Wedding, his wedding, really. He was off consummating his marriage while the slaughter ensued. To wit, his wife is now expecting a child, so there, that happened. But he has no real value as a hostage because no one's going to ransom him, but he's enormously valuable as a captive because his existence kind of allows that challenge to the legitimacy of the new owners of Riverrun that Jamie worries about. As a prisoner, he can be manipulated in a lot of, you know, big and small ways to just continue to not be, make a claim to the, you know, to Riverrun. If he has a daughter by Rosalind Frey, his new bride, they mention that she'll be married off to Emmon's son. But of course, if Rosalind gives birth to a boy, then that's a whole different issue. And we probably would have to worry about Edmure and the son and what that means for their continued existence. But for right now, he's valuable as a prisoner.
Okay, so we know that through the course of the story, the Brotherhood Without Banners, BWB, have always posed a threat to Lannister troops in the Riverlands. This goes right back. In this setting, they are the Lannisters' natural foe, and they haven't given up on their resistance in the area. So do we think the BWB pose a threat, Joe?
Absolutely, yeah. Many, many threats, I think. They've got several different sources of motivation. It could come from Lady Stoneheart. It can come from themselves because they've been fighting against these guys already for 2 years-ish. There's people who were living there long before the war started and have had their homes and families burnt and taken away from them. And for many of them, they're going to have this sense as well that they don't really know what else to do, what else is left for them. They're kind of on the edge of becoming broken men if they lose these targets. And I think it might actually be a bit of a scary time for them if the war starts winding down, and especially now Beric's gone and not all of them are with Lady Stoneheart, which I know we're going to talk about later. So some of them are going to be a little bit lost and thinking, we need a bit of a score here. We need a big hit. What do we normally do when we need that? Oh, we kill Lannisters. There's a lot of Lannisters. Maybe we can get some of them. And then we get into the additional political motivations of actually taking Edmure and Jane and stuff like Lady Gwyn said.
And how are they operating, Lady Gwyn? Because I know you've written about this kind of thing. What's their technique so far?
Well, they seem to have a pretty extensive network of spies. They've got a lot of connections in the Riverlands. They're always talking about they have various places where they have touch points, maesters, and people like Lady Smallwood and stuff like that. They have also got an established comms system. There are mentions made of signal fires or fires in the hills encircling River Run, which we take to be signal fires. They have potentially a growing armory because we have Gendry with the Smith at the forge, at the crossroads, established that he's forging arms and armor. There's a wealth of abandoned arms and armor all around the Riverlands as we move on from the war. And they certainly have the ability to arm themselves and probably a lot of other people. In terms of what they've been able to do with themselves as an organization, I think they're pretty well established kind of guerrilla organization right now, and that a lot of the people around the Riverlands who are neither Freys nor Lannisters are in on it with them.
Well, it seems like the scene could be set for some great conflict in this chapter, and it would be very exciting to read, I'm sure. And As we've touched on, we're repeatedly reminded that the Blackfish is missing, and his absence can't be ignored in a Riverlands plot. He is another danger to the Lannisters and is a highly respected military commander and mind, and someone with total loyalty to the cause of his family. From the presence of his nephew Edmure to the loss of his niece Catelyn to the capitulation of Riverrun, the Blackfish has plenty of reasons to resist and seek revenge upon Lannisters and Freys. So could we see the Blackfish reemerge in this prologue, Lady Gwyn?
Yeah, I mean, considering that he showed absolutely zero inclination to surrender or take down the direwolf banner of House Stark just a day or so before he made his escape from Riverrun. He says to Jaime, "You must be blind as well as maimed, sir. Lift your eyes and you'll see that the direwolf still flies above our walls." I highly doubt that he's just going to fade away and, you know, we'll all be sitting here going, "Whatever happened to Brendan Tully?" Well, that did happen, but not in the book. So Jaime agrees with us. It says he did not doubt that the Blackfish meant to continue the fight. Da, da, da.
Yeah, I certainly hope we see him. I was lucky enough way back when I started writing stuff for History of Westeros, the first thing Aziz asked me to do was write about the Blackfish. So that he was my favourite. I was very lucky, and I lost about a week just thinking about the possibility of this prologue and whether he would wind up with the Brotherhood or appear on his own. If he does come into the Brotherhood, that would be a mix made in heaven. I think his skills of knowing the land and knowing how outriders work and how to avoid them or defeat them, how to ambush, that all works brilliantly with the Brotherhood style that we've already seen through Aya's eyes. And I think even if he hadn't been officially charged with the duty of protecting Jane, like you mentioned, Lady Gwyn, I think he would anyway, because there isn't really a lot left. And like you say, there's no reason for him to surrender, because that's not going to buy anything. They've taken anything already. He's managed to escape, so he's really got this one option, two options of going off into the sunset or coming back and doing something. And as you said, I don't think it's going to be the first option. And it kind of needs to be now if he is going to do something. If we're assuming that this ambush is going to happen in the prologue, you can't wait until Edmure's in Casterly Rock, because he's not going to come back out again if he goes in. So it has to be now. And in terms of meeting with the Brotherhood, the one question that's always, I've never really got an answer to, is what he would do in meeting Lady Stoneheart, what kind of effect that would have on him, because he's not been exposed to any of these supernatural parts of the world that others have. We know a lot of the Brotherhood have already had a big problem with it, and some of them have split away. Some of them are used to it from Beric, and we have people like Lem who are in denial about it anyway, so I don't know if he would be in that camp. But either way, would that make him join up? Would it repulse him? We don't know, but I would like to find out, definitely. And I just want to see him anyway, because I love him.
I just want to add that even if, let's say, Thomas Evans via Edmure conveyed some sort of message to Blackfish before he made his escape, something like, "Your niece lives. She's in control of this outlaw band. You know, you guys got to work together." Nothing anyone could say could ever prepare him for the reality of what that means or what that looks like. I mean, people just, you know, you can't understand that, I think, until you see it with your own eyes. So I really do think that would be something to see, and whether we would get to see that in this chapter or sometime later is anyone's guess, but feel like that would be pretty Martinian to show us that reunion and the kind of maybe, you know, the feeling of anticipation. Well, we won't get we probably wouldn't get his, you know, inner thoughts about it, but just to imagine that he's thinking, "Oh, I'm going to see little Cat again," which is what he always called her. And then to see what she's become. I mean, the horror.
just the physical sight alone, without actually seeing what it means. That's the stuff of horror already. And then trying to wrap your head obviously around it's not really what you're used to.
That is so interesting. I haven't given that a lot of thought before, but wow, that would be a family reunion I'd like to see. Okay, so if the fact that Jane is confirmed to be in this prologue leads us to believe that there will be scenes of conflict between this Lannister contingent and an aggressor, patron B-Word wonders whereabouts the prologue will pick up. What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
Well, I think it'll be, you know, during their journey, maybe as they begin to cross the mountains, because there are mountains in between the Riverlands and the Westerlands that they're going to have to cross. I kind of have this image of the party struggling through the mountain pass or something, and maybe, you know, the wagon wheel breaks or something, you know, just the usual sort of thing that's going to happen while you're undergoing a journey like that. And then all of a sudden they find themselves surrounded and they're being attacked, maybe from in front and behind and the sides. And we'll talk a little bit about how that could be, but just I think it'll be something completely unexpected that comes upon them.
And what kind of ballpark figure for the Presta party is there? You know, how many kind of troops do we think is in this procession headed away? And what vulnerabilities might they have? What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
Well, I think we know, because Jaime, first they were going to be 100, then Jaime doubles it, and then doubles it again. So we pretty much can assume that there's about 400 men under the command of Frohley Prester. And their vulnerabilities are that, what I mentioned, they have to cross these mountains. And the route, generally speaking, would be through the pass at the Golden Tooth. And that part of it is going to be a bottleneck. And like any mountain pass, it's going to present them with some extreme vulnerabilities, I think.
Yeah, I've always had it in my mind. For some reason, I remembered it that it was a company mainly made up of archers, but that's wrong. I don't know where I got that from. But they do have specifically 10 longbowmen watching Edmure and Jane in case thing goes wrong. But other than that, they're pretty much, I can't remember how many are horse, but I know they have like a good number of knights, like 40 knights. So they are strong, but they are susceptible, as Lady Gwyn says. They would be susceptible to a ranged attack, mainly like in a bottleneck or a wood. There's no woods on the map, but we don't know. Not everything is detailed on the maps as we have them. So they could easily be both a wooded mountain pass. That'd be bad for them. And like I said earlier, the Blackfish, he knows how to use land brilliantly. We've not really seen anyone do it better than him. So, and he has been this way before. I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit there, but he has been this way. He knows how to use certain advantages. And we've also seen the Brotherhood use archers, Ayestorm them with their fire arrows. You send them in, you set all the horse lines off, everything's in chaos, and then you go in and kind of take advantage of that. So I think we could definitely see some kind of either a reimagining of that or some kind of perfect mix between the Blackfish and the Brotherhood. That's what I would vote for.
Wow. Didn't I say it sounds exciting? So, many think that it's going to be the BWB attacking. How big would a BWB contingent be? And how exactly might they attack? I was just going to answer the latter question because I was thinking about the Chet prologue, which we analysed in an episode not so long ago. And there's a plan, at least. They don't go through with it. There's a plan to attack the wildling procession that's headed to the wall. So is information about this pertinent? And is there going to be a kind of parallel? And is there going to be a similar plan of attack that the BWB could employ? I'll give you the quote and then you can make your own minds up. Their line of march will stretch for many miles. We shall fall on them in several places at once and make them swear we are 3,000, not 300. We'll hit hard and be away before their horsemen can form up to face us, Thorin Smallwood said. If they pursue, we'll lead them a merry chase, then wheel and hit again farther down the column. We'll burn their wagons, scatter their herds, and slay as many as we can. Mance Rayder himself, if we find him. If they break and return to their hovels, we've won. If not, we'll harry them all the way to the wall and see to it that they leave a trail of corpses to mark their progress. So, could this be kind of information that's pertinent to the another prologue? Because that is from the Chet prologue, and that was Old Bear talking in the beginning. And Joe, do you have something to add?
Yeah, when I saw that you put this in the notes, that blew my mind. That was a great catch. And actually, I read for your quote, and I think the wording is almost the same. When they say merry chase, I think in a Catelyn Storm chapter, when Brynden is kind of relaying what their plan was if Edmure hadn't stopped Tywin at the stone mill, they talked also about a merry chase once they were in the Westerlands, of doing basically the same kind of combat of attacking a train. Tywin's army is obviously a lot bigger than what we're dealing with here, but it would be the same concept. So that's a kind of unused plan that they didn't get to do that Brynden would have in his mind. Now, they said that was by the coast, that patch of land they found. So obviously that's not going to be in use here. But like I say, Brynden has this concept in mind that he could apply here. So yeah, they might be employing similar tactics.
I'll take the, because I think at the beginning of the question, you wanted to know how big or how many men could be, or men and women, because the Brotherhood seem to have both in their number. So, you know, how big could this group be that's attacking? Now, it's never really very clear how many are in the Brotherhood. You know, early on, they talk about hundreds or whatever. We don't know how many are still there. There's the core group seems to now be a couple to a few dozen, plus whatever supporters they pull in from the small folk. But we should also remember the remnants of the war. You've got the River Run garrison, who are unarmed, but we've talked about how the Brotherhood has the ability to arm people. We have 600 men who were left at the ford on the way to the Twins by Roose Bolton. They are under the command of Kyle Condon and Ronald Stout. Spearmen from the Rills, the Mountains, and the White Knife, 100 Hornwood longbows, some free riders and hedge knights, and a strong force of Stout and Curwyn men to stiffen them. The people that Roose probably felt would be tend to be loyal to Rob, as they were Curwyns and Stouts. So they were left behind with the expectation that they were probably a sacrifice, but we never hear about them again. Some or all of them could have survived. And then you've got other groups, possible Red Wedding survivors of Gregor's ambush of Roose Bolton's rear guard that you hear about, men who went with Mage Mormont and Galbert Glover. They took a contingent of men with them. What they went into the Nick, but what happened to them? We don't really know what's happened with them since that point. And then, of course, you got the Riverlands is full of people who didn't accompany Rob to the Red Wedding. Rob brought only his northern troops with him, leaving the River Lords with their forces intact. These men have all nominally at this point bent the knee, but you know, we think there's a very good chance that any number of them could still be loyal to Stark and Tully. So as far as numbers go, who knows? As far as I see it, sky's the limit, because pretty much everyone in the Riverlands who isn't a Frey or a Lannister could be in on this.
Yeah, I'm really interested. It's probably one of my top five questions about Winds is what the Brotherhood actually looks like now post Beric into the Stoneheart era, because we really don't know at all. We get a real quick glimpse in Brienne's final feast chapter, so we know some of them are with Stoneheart, but there's plenty who are missing that we've seen before. And we don't know if they've just been sent somewhere else on a mission, if they've left because they don't want to be part of this creepy dead woman's thing. We don't know if that abandonment is them just quitting entirely, or are they just sticking to what they believe Beric's original mission was and have kind of gone rogue and set off a completely different section. So We don't know who is where, because we don't know where Greenbeard is, and he's kind of noted as a possible leader, I think, by Aya in her chapters. The Mad Huntsman, they were both sent south of the Manda, but they easily could have got back up now, and he really hates Lannisters, so he could be quite in on this one. Is Edric Dane going to turn up? I would say no, but like you say, Lady Gwyn, it could be anyone. That's how good the phrase and Lannisters are at pissing everyone off, is that anyone could be their enemy now.
Oh dear, they've upset too many people, finally. So, I was wondering, we're talking about the BWB, and we're almost assuming that it's them that's going to come into conflict with the Lannisters. But isn't it possible that this attack might not involve the BWB, and instead it could be Blackfish with the River Run garrison? Why don't you explain this, Lady Gwyn?
Well, you know, we have to think about all possibilities, right? And it is possible, because even though there was an opportunity for Thomas Evans to speak to Edmure, who then went into River Run and spoke to presumably his uncle before he escaped, and we think that could be a way for brotherhood sort of messages to have flowed between this whole group of people, we also have to acknowledge the possibility that that didn't happen, or that Blackfish didn't want to hear it and maybe had his own plan in mind. And maybe his escape was just simply coordinated with the members of the garrison who were his soldiers, men that he would trust, that Edmure had assurances from Jaime that they would be released. Of course, in that case, the problem of arms and armor would be what the issue was. But let's think about Brynden Tully. He was apparently the mastermind behind the great Stark-Tully victory at Oxcross, which involved circumventing the Golden Tooth, which is that pass that we keep talking about, via a secret path, which was discovered by Grey Wind. So there he is. He's got his garrison now at large, and with the problem of arms and armor, of course. So we could think of ways around that, I guess, if we must. But what if, you know, this group somehow gets together and they're going to make the attempt to free Edmure and Jaime? I mentioned earlier that he's been charged with her safety. But even if not, if he hadn't been, Joe said he would probably still be trying to save these people. Remember the Tully words, family, duty, honor. Blackfish would be fulfilling his duty as warden of the Southern Marches and protector of the Queen by rescuing his surviving family and annihilating the Lannister host under Forley's command. So standing and fighting, I think, is probably the most honorable and very characteristic action. So I think I hit all the family duty honor there, right? So also, we've talked a lot about how great he is at using the land as, you know, in his favor. So being familiar with the lay of the land, he could easily take the goat track and block the further end of the pass at the Golden Tooth. You've got a natural choke point there that's easily encircled with proper planning, and you wouldn't actually need too great of a force to do that. You know, a few to go ahead and cause some sort of barrier that would stop the party from going forward. Another party to come up around the back to stop them from going back. It actually is a lot like Whispering Wood, now that I'm talking about it, because then you have the ones on the sides that would come down. So a little bit of a different landscape, but a very similar tactic. It would work, and that it would definitely be put these 400 men in a place where they had no retreat and probably very little cover. So obviously, the worry would be about the prisoners being executed, because Jaime was very clear about the fact that, you know, if either of them put a toe out of line, they're to be shot, because he doesn't want to see either of them being used as that rallying point. Jaime, say what you will, he is nobody's fool. So, you know, if this rescue was going to be executed successfully, it would have to be pretty surgical, but you'd have to assume that if there was some sort of plan like this, Edmure would know about it, because it would have been made before he left, right? So one other detail about the Golden Tooth. House Lefford, which is the house who resides at the Fortress of the Golden Tooth, is now ruled by a widow, the widow of Lord Lefford, who's somebody who all these Lannisters that drowned because they insisted on wearing armor when they were fighting around water. So he's one of the ones, he drowned at the Battle of the Fords, which was Edmure's great victory. And just to point out that Forley Prester has multiple associations with this pass at the Golden Tooth. From the very beginning, he was part of the army that was stationed there, that fought their way into the Riverlands. He retreated through there after the Battle of the Camps. And, you know, it would be totally within keeping of the story to see him up there again, wouldn't it?
It would be.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And what themes do we think could be explored if this attack happens? And how would this set up the whole book of The Winds of Winter? Patrons Christine and Quarren Halfhand wonder what the prologue will tease about the book ahead. If we open The Winds of Winter and it begins like this, what do you think we're going to expect from the rest of the book, Joe?
Well, how long have you got, really? This could be the whole episode right here, couldn't it? This is a lot of things have got to fit into Winds, obviously, thematically and plot-wise, and I think the prologue is going to be a big part of that. I think George really is going to aim for two statements with this opening chapter that we've been waiting for so long. We know he's already tipped Winds as the everything gets worse book. The you think we've had it bad so far, you've seen nothing yet, I'm going to be much, much worse, watch this type thing. And he's going to set that tone right here in the prologue, I believe. I think it's going to be grim. I think it's going to be morally very dark. And it's really going to be like, what are we actually holding in our hands? Firstly, we're happy we've got it, but this is actually quite heavy already. And I don't think George ever panders to the audience or anything like that. But I do think the fact that we've had a probably 10-year wait, Winds isn't going to come out and then pull its punches. We're kind of really hit the ground running and, like I say, set the tone straight off. And personally, I think his second point, more to the plot of the prologue in terms of theme, is it's going to be that the magical element, again, I'm jumping forward a little bit here without saying the magical W word, the magical element is going to no longer be on the periphery, because every other prologue we've had has been on the edge, down in Old Town, up above the wall, out on Dragonstone, where this one is just leaving the centre now. And this is going to be a big thing that no one's going to be able to hide from. This is going to be big news all over the Riverlands and all over the Westeros of possibly captives escaping or dying or whatever it is, and a big 400-strong company something happening to them. So this isn't going to be hidden above the wall or anything like that. And I think George is really telling us that there's no hiding places anymore. This is going to be affecting everyone. The whole place is in trouble, basically, and he can come for anyone with his wolves or his dragons or his others, and this is what we can expect from Winds. But for the overall theme, I think Winds itself is going to mostly focus on vengeance and the bad consequences of it. We've had that already all through the first 5 books, but I think we're really going to focus on how bad getting vengeance can be. We've only really seen the strive to get it. Now I think we're going to actually see people receiving it and it not going well. I think well-laid plans going wrong is going to be a big part of Wins, and I think that's going to be here in this prologue. And more violence, and violence only be getting more violence, which again we've especially seen during Feast and the Riverlands, but I think we're going to see that in Captured here as well. And yeah, like I said, because this is just going to go so wrong, we can assume someone is probably going to be killed when not supposed to, at least the POV we can assume. Again, I think we'll see the Stoneheart's vengeance actually looks very different in reality to what we might think on our heads. We think, oh yeah, brilliant, yeah, get the Freys, get the Lannisters, they're bad. But now we're actually going to see it in reality, and ooh, it's actually going to be, oh, I probably shouldn't have wished for this. I need to go away and think about myself, what kind of person I am, because that's what George is quite good at doing.
Yeah, I fail to see that George would give a positive message about revenge. Ultimately, he might tempt us, he might make us feel like it's a good ride, but ultimately we're going to get a slap in the face for wanting blood, right? He's that kind of guy. So moving on, while we know that Jane Westerling will be in the prologue, Georgia stated that she won't be the POV, as we discussed. So why don't we go through the likely candidates for the POV status, remembering that prologues must function as short stories, and the choice of POV really does colour the events that we witness because it's through somebody's eyes. We're likely to learn much and more about the inner world of this POV, and so it's a huge call from George to bestow this kind of honour onto a certain character. So who will that character be? We're going to go through some of the likely people, and I will kind of give the lowdown, and you two can kind of give the pros and cons. So I want to start with a theory that kind of emerged a few years ago, and this is the King's Justice, Illyn Payne. He's an executioner who has been mute since the Mad King took his tongue. Normally stationed in King's Landing, Illyn is taken by Jaime to Riverrun. On the journey, Illyn and Jaime begin sparring practice, and Illyn proves to be the perfect partner in this regard because of his permanent silence, so Jaime can kind of make his fumbles and mistakes without ruining his street cred. And he knows Illyn will not mutter a word or seek to humiliate him. But there's some big problems with this theory, Lady Gwyn.
Well, you know, the biggest problem is that he's still at River Run after the group leave. As many as there's 2 or 3 days afterwards, he's out with Jaime, training with Jaime, and then he's never mentioned again. But I have to say that I think that Illyn Payne going to Casterly Rock would not make sense. And he's certainly leaving River Run to kind of hurry up and catch up with the group wouldn't make sense. He's the King's Justice. His place is in King's Landing. He's been a part of Jaime's tale since they left King's Landing. And Jaime goes off to Raventree. Whether Illyn Payne accompanies him on that journey or not, it's not specifically stated. It just says he has his tale with him. So he could be there, or he could have stayed behind at Riverrun. But the fact is, he was definitely not with the group that headed west with Forley Prester, and by some days he was behind, still at Riverrun. So sadly, I think we have to let go of the Illyn Payne theory.
Yeah, as interesting as an Illyn Payne chapter would be, and all that he knows, I think it's officially debunked. It would take something quite extraordinary to have him in the right place at the right time. So why don't we move on to someone that I think all of us agree is a fairly strong candidate at the least, and that is our man Forley Prester. As we heard, Forley Prester is in charge of the party. He wears a surcoat with a bull design and horns on his helmet, so look out for that. Jaime thinks he looks like an innkeeper, so a kind of plain looking man. He is a trusted Lannister man, enough to lead troops and this party. He is told to kill Edmure and Jane if they try and escape. Another thing you should really pay attention to there, which could be pertinent information. And here's an interesting quote from his conversation with Jamie. "Scouts and outriders will screen our march and will fortify our camps by night. I have picked 10 men to stay with Tully day and night. My best longbowman. If he should ride so much as a foot off the road, they will loose so many shafts at him that his own mother would take him for a goose." Lady Gwyn.
Well, Forley Prester is definitely my pick. He's always been my pick. You know, he'd be a great person to be the point of view. I think he would fall kind of in the same category of point of views as Cresson, as, you know, the kind of loyal retainer trying to do the right thing, but suddenly faced with something completely unexplainable or possibly supernatural. Will, I think, falls into that category as well, though he's not really a retainer, but, you know, he's a loyal member of the Night's Watch, kind of doing the same thing, you know, just out there trying to do his job and do everything right that's expected of him, and then suddenly being in this bizarre situation. I think it is pertinent that he seems quite bemused by the notion that Jane, who he calls Gawain's girl, you know, I think he knows her father, so he just can't really countenance the idea that she might try to escape. So I wonder if his maybe unconscious urge to trust Jane might prove to be his undoing.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I think he's my pick as well, because every prologue we've seen so far, they've had a small internal mission, and he kind of fits that description best of these people that we know are there. That doesn't mean that other characters we know are there won't have one that we just don't know about yet, but that's the one that's most obvious to us. I think it'd be really fascinating to see this chapter through the eyes of someone, like I said earlier, who's got a plan and is trying to keep it together and fails in probably a quite chaotic way. And, you know, there can be a lot of moral dilemmas there, whether he has to do, whether he has to shoot Edmure and Jane, whether he kind of cracks and thinks, no, I can't do that, and now I'm going to try and protect them and go against orders. And there's all those kind of oath themes in there. I just don't think George can resist writing a line where someone says something so confidently and not have it kind of come back and bite them. I think that's just George all over there. So I could definitely see that happening.
Okay, so why don't we talk about another candidate? Sybil Spicer, mother of Jane Westerling, noted for being Maggie the Frog's granddaughter. So it's almost a nice bit of trivia there. Strange bit of information. She was ultimately complicit in the death of Robb Stark, a fact she confesses to Jaime. She betrayed the North in order to gain political favours, but perhaps now harbours some regrets. And I just wanted to point out, as an observation I made, that if it was Sybil, it would be the first female point of view in a prologue, which I only realised like yesterday. But anyway, Joe, what do you think of Sybil's status as a POV?
Yeah, she'd probably be my silver medalist, another strong candidate, my second choice. I'd really like to have a female prologue POV. If people over on the Isle of Faces, we've been talking about the occurrence of female chapters, and that did come up that we haven't had a prologue POV yet, so that'd definitely be interesting. She's another mother character, which I always enjoy. This is obviously quite a different approach to motherhood than most of the ones we've seen before, and she does fit into that kind of Chet Varamyr role of someone that we already know and definitely do not like. So that would be quite a way to open the book. We open it up, our blood starts boiling immediately because we hate Sybil for all she's done to Jane and to Rob and everyone else extended. So I think we'd initially be chomping at the bit to see her get her comeuppance and think, yeah, she's a POV, she's going to die, this is great, can't wait for it. And again, it's that same thing like I said before, we want it, then we see it happen and we think, oh, I probably shouldn't have wanted that because now this poor woman's being torn about by wolves or attacked by multiple parties or whatever it might be. So I would think that could be a really strong candidate. And like I say, in terms of people having a mission and having an internal mini plot almost within a prologue chapter, she could definitely be someone like that, because you can bet she's scheming of some way to get what she wanted out of the Lannisters or get out of this deal somehow. So yeah, she'd have a strong vote from me.
Excellent. And there's also her husband, is that how you say it? Gawain Westerling. I've never said it out loud before. And he's the head of his house. And he was taken prisoner by Jason Mallister and was captive when Robb Stark stormed the crag, his family seat, while his wife conspired with Tywin regarding Robb's betrayal. Garwyn was set free due to the Robb-Jane marriage. But in a difference to his wife, he's really considered honourable and doesn't seem to have partaken in much of Sybil's scheming. So I was wondering if he could perhaps be a more sympathetic POV that, you know, doesn't really deserve any of this. Well, perhaps he does. That's for you to decide. But if he wasn't complicit in what his wife is, then the question's being asked of us. Why don't we move on to Edmure? Now, this might be a long shot. Edmure Tully is the brother of Catelyn Tully and is the original heir to Riverrun. His marriage to Roslyn Frey was marred by the treacherous events of the Red Wedding. Who can forget that? He's been captive ever since. At Riverrun, he's forced to stand every day with a noose around his neck in an attempt to make the Blackfish concede until he escapes. Edmure is sent with Fawley Prester's armed escort as a permanent Lannister hostage. Permanent, guys. If he is allowed to make it west, it might then be impossible to recover him, underlining the importance of this supposed mission, right? So Lannisters would rather see him dead than put a foot into freedom. What do you think, Joe? Could Edmure be a surprise POV?
I sure hope not, because I'm a big fan of Edmure. I love me some Edmure. I understand his flaws, but I like him myself. I think the biggest chance against him being the POV is I wonder if George would dare to kill him off in this manner in a prologue POV, because that would pretty much be it for the Tullys then, unless Brynden is suddenly going to do a big lifestyle change. And that would be the first great family to actually go. It's not like the show where pretty much all of them are just completely wiped out. The closest would be Robert Arryn, but we know there's kind of subsets of Arryn through the veil, so it's not quite the same. We don't get that sense of the Tullys. It seems to just be this family, and like I say, they'd be gone. So to be fair, I don't see us getting through this series with all the same nine-ish great families being the same ones in power. So some of them have got to go sometime. And the Riverlands are the most used to switching rulers. They've only been around for 300 years. Riverrun's only been the ruling castle for 300 years, which is the blink of an eye in Westerosi history. So I could see that happening, but I hope it's not.
Excellent. Okay, I just want to brush through a few other ideas that we have. I don't think we've got time to critique them one by one. But the BWB, I mean, we're thinking about this, that we're going to see it through the eyes of the Lannister kind of caravan, but it could be through the eyes of the BWB kind of stalking. They could be stalking them and they could come upon them and attack them, and we could see what happens to Edmure and Jane through the BWB's eyes. And that could be, you know, a large number of people as possibilities there. One wild card that Lady Gwyn likes is Reynold Westerling, because she's never been convinced that Reynold's alive.
Dead. He is alive. He's not dead. But it would be a shame for him to be the prologue character, because he'd go from being not dead to being really dead. And that would be just too bad.
And there's always the chance that it could be a nobody, you know, someone that we're not, haven't been privy to before, so some other character who George has, you know, maybe name dropped or not even name dropped, because that has happened in the prologues before. We don't always know them. Okay, so that was our kind of POV rundown. Let's move on. We have had five prologue POV so far, and when considering them side by side, certain patterns emerge. It's good to note that George is certainly not bound to upkeep these supposed patterns, but we can wonder, as kind of fans and theorists, if there's a chance that they might be repeated. So the first thing is that I think all the prologues have been new settings, right, Lady Gwyn?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, this could be sort a new setting. I mean, in that it's further west. It's maybe our first glimpse of a place that's been often mentioned but never seen, that area around the Golden Tooth, which, you know, has come up so many times throughout the course of the War of the Five Kings. So, you know, we finally get to see that and really understand, you know, what it was like or why it's important.
Okay, and being bestowed with the prologue POV mantle is almost a kiss of death, given that POVs seem to either die in their prologue or soon after. Do we imagine the POV will die in the Winds of Winter prologue? And is that something we should expect from the first page? Like, we open the book, finally in our hands, we realise who the POV is, and then our first thought is, well, you know, you've got 20 pages left.
R.I.P. Yeah, I would say yes. 99.9% of my brain says yes, but you get George's clarification regarding Jane being not the POV character, but just in the prologue. That indicates that he knows we're on to this. So could he mix it up? I mean, I don't think he would do that, honestly. In fact, I'm 100% sure he wouldn't do that just for the sake of confounding fans. But he is welcome to break that pattern at any point if it works for the narrative. So, you know, who knows? There is a percentage of a chance that that's not the way it works out.
Okay, and another kind of pattern that's emerged. In A Game of Thrones, we get to see the magical others. Then in A Clash of Kings, we saw Melisandre swallowing poison in a magical way. In A Storm of Swords, there were more magical others. And in A Feast for Crows, we saw glass candles and glamours. And finally in Dance, we witnessed magical warging and second life. So magic is evident in every prologue. Perhaps George likes to give us this kind of exposition in these chapters where he can. Patron Paul H. wonders if magic will be involved in this prologue. And I'm going to say that Paul H. said about Nymeria's wolf pack, which is warging. So that's a really good point, Paul. And we're going to come back to the wolf pack a bit later, because Arya is magically in a wolf from across the narrow sea. But what about Stoneheart, Lady Gwyn? What's the chances of some Stoneheart?
You know, I mean, it certainly could be. The timeline seems to allow for it. She's not new to us, but she would definitely be new to the characters in this chapter. I mean, the rumors of the existence of the Hangwoman are still quite sparse. Beyond the Brotherhood, no one has connected that character with the Revenant, Catelyn Stark. No one even, you know, there's no hint that she's actually some kind of undead creature. She's just this kind of mysterious woman that might be, rumors has it, maybe took over from Beric, or, you know, she's around doing things. So certainly it would be news to all of the people in the story if all of a sudden undead Catelyn Stark descended upon them.
Quite the effect on the battle morale as well. If you see a woman you've already killed start walking towards you, that might be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, with those red tears, you'd be scared, man, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Yeah. Drop my sword. I'm off.
Okay, I want to conclude today by considering what wildcards could affect the story. So, George...
Wildcards? Did you say wildcards? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was promoting his main book series, Wildcards.
I thought we were talking about A Song of Ice and Fire.
So the wildcards in the story, George never veers too far away from tragedy. It's like the central archetype of many of these plot lines in his saga. We're told that Forley Prester must kill Jane and Edmure rather than let them escape. Does this sound a bit ominous, guys? If there's a large ambush, it will be difficult to separate the foe from the hostages and help the hostages escape, right? Being surrounded with so many guards who seems one purpose is to kill them if they try and escape. So listener Yogi wonders if the ambush could lead to the deaths of either or both of Jane and Edmure. Lady Gwyn.
Well, in my opinion, the swiftness of George correcting the record where he said, I didn't say she was the prologue character, I said she was in the prologue, kind of indicates, you know, that she will live. I don't think, if he wanted to leave that ambiguous, I don't think he would have so quickly jumped on re-answering a question that he had already sort of given an answer to. So don't forget that the context of the original statement in the panel that he was sitting on was talking about the differences between Talisa, Rob's show wife, and Jane. So I think that George was quite keen to emphasize that Jane is still alive. And also, he did not want us to come away with the impression that she was still alive, only to be killed off in the first chapter of The Winds of Winter. So he seems to me like he has some plans for her. As for Edmure, I don't know. What do you guys, I mean, you guys think, we hope that it's, you know, not bad news for Edmure, right?
Well, I like Joe's point earlier that, you know, things could go awry, right, Joe?
Yeah, I think chaos is almost guaranteed, whether it's the Brotherhood, whether it's Brynden, whether George is even cute enough to have them both attack at the same time. I don't think he will, but it could. Whether wolves show up, I think something's going to go wrong. And I'd be very surprised if both of them get out unscathed, at least. Something's going to go wrong. We might have an injury. We might just have... I mean, Jane doesn't like wolves already, so if she sees a huge pack of them, then she's really going to have her nerves frayed. Just seeing a bad slaughter, whatever. Yeah, like I said already, it's not going to be a happy chapter, so I don't think things are going to go as Edmure and Jane would want the day to go.
Yes, so maybe it's going to be a roller coaster. Maybe we'll be pumping our fists like as we were when Catelyn wanted to arrest Tyrion. We're all like this, and then later down the line we're kind of looking back like, no, I never pumped my fist.
And that big war happened and we're all
oh, maybe that wasn't so bad.
Okay, so George said we'll see Casterly Rock at some point, and he wasn't just talking about the Winds of Winter, he just meant in the some point in the saga. So does this information tell us anything about how the prologue could go? Patron Aegon the Sixth wonders if the Rock could feature in the prologue. What do you think, Joe?
I would say no, to be honest. I would lean more towards no, because they would have to be so deep in Westerland's territory by then that an ambush would be a really, really bad idea. They would have had to get ahead of them by quite some margin, survive in enemy territory for all this time, and then get back out of it. There's no real point in freeing Edmure and then still having 100 miles to go just to get him out of enemy territory. So I would lean towards no myself. Maybe we get it kind of, you see it on the horizon and then something happens, but I think the likelihood is pretty low myself.
Okay, so what about Jaime and Brienne? Because they've been captured by the BWB, as we know. Brienne said that she'd swear her sword, right? So the BWB want them to do something with this sword. Could Jaime and or Brienne be involved in this potential ambush, Lady Gwyn?
No, I think whatever they're going to do or whatever happens with Jaime and Brienne, which is the thing that I most want to know about, it probably isn't this. So I accepted that I'm not going to find out in the prologue, because they're at least a week or more, probably more, behind the Prester party when they meet at Penny Tree. I mean, if you read that last Jaime chapter in Feast, days go by. It's the next day and the next day and the next day. You can count off the days and it's many days. And then he goes to Raventree. So, and then plus however long that happens. So a week, maybe 2 weeks. I just don't see how they could be involved in this ambush.
Okay, so they might not be involved in this attack, but there might be another attack on River Run in the Winds of Winter on a larger scale, right? So are the two things linked in your mind, Lady Gwyn? And could the BWB be involved in both?
Yes. I mean, I see that there's going to be some smaller things that happen early in the Winds of Winter that ultimately are this side retrieving all of their captives before the next big offensive, which would be, you know, the Red Wedding 2.0 that has been predicted. You've got these captives going west, which I think have to be retrieved. And then don't forget that the Red Wedding captives were ordered by Jaime Lannister to be sent to King's Landing. The phrase kind of, you know, they stomped their feet a little bit, but they're probably going to go back and send them south. And I have no doubt that, you know, being Freys, they'll screw that up and all those guys will be rescued. So really what this is about for in terms of revenge is probably reducing the risk that you have captives that can be used as leverage or that can be executed because some sort of revenge was taken. That might not work out exactly the way they are hoping or that they want it to, though.
Wow, that is a great thought, that this prologue chapter is merely groundwork for something far larger and maybe far more horrific.
I think there might be a slight irony because, like you say, Jaime gives that order. And so if the captives are out of the twins and away from River Run, it might just open the door a bit. Oh, now we can actually go for it. And like we've said, this one could go wrong. So if Lady Stoneheart hears, hey, we tried to free your brother, but they actually just shot him rather than let us have him, then she might be thinking, well, God damn it, right, fine, all bets are off then, let's just storm the place, let's not even care who's in there, let's go proper to the max now if you're going to act that way. So this, that you say, Yokeboy, this could definitely be groundwork or motivation for Stoneheart just being even worse than she intended to be.
Wow. I'll drink it in. So the final point that I want to address is that we know there's a Chekhov's wolf pack roaming the Riverlands, led by Arya's Nymeria, and she's kind of having these long-distance dreams about it. Could the wolves involve themselves in this prologue situation? And if so, what are your thoughts on some of the possibilities of them appearing, and you know, what kind of function are they going to serve? Lady Gwyn.
Well, first of all, Arya has these chapters in Braavos wherein she wargs Nymeria in her dreams pretty much every night from the way she thinks about it. But these take place in tandem with Jaime's feast chapters. So you get a chapter where she mentions having dreamed of snow in the Riverlands. So my initial thought is probably not, they're not instrumental, because in that case, we might have seen it through Arya's eyes, because the snow in the Riverlands happens in Jaime's final feast chapter once this party has left several days earlier. So incidentally, that dream where she sees snow seems to involve a shepherd and his flock. So it, that's, you know, something sort of unrelated, something minor. But, you know, she, like I said, she does dream about or kind of dream in, she's warging Nymeria in her dreams every night. So unreliable narrator, you don't know that she could have dreamed something that she doesn't later think about. And we don't get the details, because even though she's doing this pretty much every night, we really only get the details of what she dreams about once or twice. So, you know, as far as what the possibilities are, if that's the case, I mean, imagine a wolf attack either before, during, or after that choke point ambush. I mean, it would just add to chaos, and it would be, you know, something that Joe referenced earlier, like, you know, just to sort of like many things happening at once that weren't all planned to happen, and things kind of going. Do wolves know the difference between friend and foe? I don't know. But Joe, you have some thoughts on wolves, I think.
I have many, many thoughts on wolves, but I will restrain myself and not take up another half an hour of your time. This is my where I fall down for theory making and theory crafting, like you're all so good at, is because I run into something that's a logical stop point and I just kind of move around it for what I want to happen, which is definitely the wolves. I want the wolves to be here and I hope they turn up, even though I will obviously not like it when they actually get down to business. But I just think they make too much sense for this prologue in terms of the theme and how previous prologues are structured. We already said about the magical element often just seeping in the last few pages in past prologues, so that makes sense. And I think it hits brilliantly on that earlier idea we talked about with George making a point about glorified vengeance, because we all love Nymeria and the idea of a great big wolf pack running around and eating Lannisters. We'd all sign up for that. That sounds right up our street. But then if it all goes wrong and it's chaotic and then they're stampeding and then they're eating everyone, like you say, instead of who they're supposed to be eating. And I didn't even look at this in terms of Aya being present or warging or controlling or whatever. Wolves get hungry and there's a lot of men there. And we already know they're attacking bigger and bigger parties. So that could be part of it. But I think where it fits in most and the idea like, of it best is this magic is a sword without a hilt type thing that I think is going to be another huge part of Winds as Daenerys progresses with the dragons and Euron starts blowing horns and raising krakens and then there's big wolves everywhere. And I just think it fits in so well with what we might see in terms of Aya, especially in terms of revenge and it not looking like we had hoped and it looking darker. So I think that really mirrors here with Nymeria and the wolves, and I think you can really apply it to Aya and what she might be getting up to in Winds. And we already worry about Bran and his warging. We don't know what Rickon's going to look like. Sansa's being mentored by Peter Baelish, so she's not going to come out morally clean. There's no chance. I think that would be a big point of the overall story from George, is that this family that we started with and they were all children that we love so much, I think they're going to all play a big part in saving the world or saving humanity or whatever you want to call it. But I don't think they're going to get away morally clean. Like I say, it's going to cost them something. I think this is a really good way to show that, of this thing that we love, oh, the cute little wolf puppy, actually being this uncontrollable force of nature that we're not really supposed to have, and it messing everything up.
Just like dragons.
Yeah, precisely. And it fits with the older Time for Wolves discarded title, because people thought that meant, oh good, the starts are coming back, and I always thought that might actually be a dark message. Yeah, right. You think
great. So Joe, Sir Buckley, thanks for coming on the show today. You've been a great guest.
Thank you for having me.
I want you to do two things. I want you to tell us about your podcast, and then I want you to tell us and show us, hopefully, your Westerosi themed book that you've authored, which is very impressive. Go ahead.
I thought you were going to ask me to sing. I was going about to log off.
That would please some people, but we won't have to put you on that spot.
I don't think my mic can handle it. The podcast, Dial of Faces, we are kind of a sister podcast to A History of Westeros, as they do their Valor Aredis projects. We do our Scraps and Scrolls episodes. We pick up everything that Aziz doesn't have time to get to, which is actually a surprising amount. I mean, I still leave stuff on the cutting room floor as well. So if anyone wants to pick up a third podcast, then they're welcome to. We could probably get four or five going, the amount of stuff we get from these books. And yeah, there is a book behind me somewhere. It's a bit of a chunky one. Great Castles of Westeros. There it is. It does exist, quite large. And yeah, like you say, it is basically what the title says, is a guide to all the great castles of Westeros, all the big ones. And that's, I guess it must have had its 6-month birthday recently, somewhere near that. And it seems to be quite popular, so thanks for shouting that out. I mainly use it to weigh down my Dreamcast lid, because it comes up if I don't put anything on. It's quite good for that.
So where would one purchase this Castles of Westeros book?
It's on the old Amazon. You can find it if you search the title or my name. It'll come up. I'm sure it's on my Twitter somewhere. I normally put a link somewhere or other.
Might be on your Twitter.
Yes, probably. Yeah.
Yes, okay, which is @SirBuckley.
That's right, yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't have a banner prepared because we had a power outage prior to this, and I got a little discombobulated with our preparation. So anyways, we did not have a power outage during, which is what really matters. So thank you to the storm god for really holding off there. We got through it, and this was a great discussion, possibly maybe record discussion for our streams of winter. We managed to get our producer to give us a little extra time, which was good. thank you Joe for being here. Next week I want to tell you guys, actually next week is the 4th of July here, it's a national holiday. We will be taking that off, but also we had a previously planned family vacation which runs from the 11th through the 18th, and we have plans with family for those two weekends. So we're going to be taking a little bit of a hiatus for the next 3 weeks. We will, that is also lucky for all of you and for us, going to give us the time to finish our next Winds of Winter Primer episode 3, which is what this topic that we've been talking about today is all relevant to. Our upcoming Winds of Winter Primer episode, which will be all about the Riverlands, Jaime, Brienne, Lady Stoneheart, the Brotherhood Without Banners. So hopefully by the time we come back in a few weeks, we will have that all finished. And our guest on that episode will be talking about Brienne with our friend Tana Ford, who is the Eisner and Hugo Award nominated artist, formerly host of the Westeros Whenever-ly podcast, longtime member of the fandom. She's responsible for our profile pics. If you follow us on Twitter or Facebook, we're really excited to welcome her to the podcast. So yeah, back over to you, Yoke Boy. Lead us out.
Yes, so a small break, but we'll be back July 25th for some more Streams of Winter. We're not going to stop until we've done all the POVs. Thanks for all your support towards the live stream so far, and thanks to each and every one of our patrons who support us. If you want to support us as a patron too, please know we do have a Patreon campaign which includes all manner of incentives. So guys, thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you soon.
Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.